Neuromancer by William Gibson. Continued. Cassette 5, Side 2. Power in Case's world meant corporate power. The Zaibatsus, the multinationals that shaped the course of human history, had transcended old barriers. Viewed as organisms, they had attained a kind of immortality. You couldn't kill a Zaibatsu by assassinating a dozen key executives. There were others waiting to step up the ladder, assume the vacated position, access the vast banks of corporate memory. But Tessier Ashpool wasn't like that, and he sensed the difference in the death of its founder. T.A. was an atavism, a clan. He remembered the litter of the old man's chamber, the soiled humanity of it, the ragged spines of the old audio discs in their paper sleeves, one foot bare, the other in a velvet slipper. The brawn plucked at the hood of the modern suit, and Molly turned left through another archway. Wintermute and the Nest. Phobic vision of the hatching wasps, time-lapse machine gun of biology. But weren't the Zaibatsus more like that, or the Yakuza? Hives with cybernetic memories, vast single organisms, their DNA coated in silicon? If Straylight was an expression of the corporate identity of Tessier Ashpool, then T.A. was crazy as the old man had been. The same ragged tangle of fears, the same strange sense of aimlessness. If they'd turned into what they wanted to, he remembered Molly saying. But Wintermute had told her they hadn't. Case had always taken it for granted that the real bosses, the kingpins in a given industry, would be both more and less than people. He'd seen it in the men who'd crippled him in Memphis. He'd seen Wage affect the semblance of it in Night City, and it had allowed him to accept Armitage's flatness and lack of feeling. He'd always imagined it as a gradual and willing accommodation of the machine, the system, the parent organism. It was the root of street cool, too, the knowing posture that implied connection, invisible lines up to hidden levels of influence. But what was happening now in the corridors of Villa Straylight? Whole stretches were being stripped back to steel and concrete. "Wonder where our Peter is now, huh? Maybe see that boy soon," she muttered. "And Armitage, where's he, Case?" "Dead," he said, knowing she couldn't hear him. "He's dead." He flipped. The Chinese program was face-to-face with the target ice, rainbow tints gradually dominated by the green rectangle representing the TA cores, arches of emerald across the colorless void. "How's it go, Dixie?"
"Fine. Too slick. Thing's amazing. Should have had one that time in Singapore. Did the old New Bank of Asia for a good 50th of what they were worth. But that's ancient history. This baby takes all the drudgery out of it. Makes you wonder what a real war would be like now."
"If this kind of shit was on the street, we'd be out of job," Case said.
"You wish. Wait till you're steering that thing upstairs through black ice."
"Sure." Something small and decidedly non-geometric had just appeared on the far end of one of the emerald arches.
"Dixie."
"Yeah, I see it. Don't know if I believe it."
A brownish dot, a dull gnat against the green wall of the TA cores. It began to advance across the bridge built by Quang Grade Mark 11, and Case saw that it was walking. As it came, the green section of the arch extended, the polychrome of the virus program rolling back, a few steps ahead of the cracked black shoes.
"Gotta hand it to you, boss," the flatline said when the short, rumpled figure of the Finn seemed to stand a few meters away. "I never seen anything this funny when I was alive."
But the eerie non-laugh didn't come.
"I never tried it before," the Finn said, showing his teeth, his hands bunched in the pockets of his frayed jacket.
"You killed Armitage," Case said.
"Corto, yeah. Armitage was already gone. Had to do it. I know. You want to get the enzyme. Okay, no sweat. I was the one gave it to Armitage in the first place. I mean, I told him what to use. But I think maybe it's better to let the deal stand. You got enough time. I'll give it to you. Only a couple of hours now, right?"
Case watched blue smoke billow in cyberspace as the Finn lit up one of his Partagas.
"You guys," the Finn said, "you're a pain. The flatline here, if you were all like him, it would be real simple. He's a construct, just a bunch of ROM, so he always does what I expect him to. My projections said there wasn't much chance of Molly wandering in on Ashpool's big exit scene. I'll give you one example. He sighed.
Why'd he kill himself? Case asked.
Why's anybody kill himself?
The figure shrugged.
I guess I know, if anybody does, but it would take me 12 hours to explain the various factors in his history and how they interrelate. He was ready to do it for a long time, but he kept going back into the freezer. Christ, he was a tedious old fuck.
The Finn's face wrinkled with disgust.
It's all tied in with why he killed his wife, mainly. You want the short reason. But what sent him over the edge for good and all? Little 3-Jane figured a way to fiddle the program that controlled his cryogenic system. Subtle, too. So basically, she killed him. Except he figured he'd killed himself. And your friend, the avenging angel, figures she got him with an eyeball full of shellfish juice.
The Finn flicked his butt away into the matrix below.
Well, actually, I guess I did give 3-Jane the odd hint. A little of the old how-to, you know.
Wintermute, Case said, choosing the words carefully. You told me you were just a part of something else. Later on, you said you wouldn't exist, if the run goes off and Molly gets the word into the right slot. The Finn's streamlined skull nodded.
Okay, then who are we going to be dealing with then? If Armitage is dead and you're going to be gone, just who exactly is going to tell me how to get these fucking toxin sacks out of my system? Who's going to get Molly back out of there? I mean, where exactly are all our asses going to be? We cut you loose from the hardwiring.
The Finn took a wooden toothpick from his pocket and regarded it critically, like a surgeon examining a scalpel.
Good question, he said finally. You know salmon, kind of fish? These fish, see, they're compelled to swim upstream. Got it?
No, Case said.
Well, I'm under compulsion myself, and I don't know why. If I were going to subject you to my very own thoughts, let's call them speculations on the topic, it would take a couple of your lifetimes, because I've given it a lot of thought, and I just don't know. But when this is over, we do it right, I'm going to be part of something bigger, much bigger.
The Finn glanced up and around the matrix.
But the parts of me that are me now, that'll still be here, and you'll get your payoff.
Case fought back an insane urge to punch himself forward and get his fingers around the figure's throat, just above the ragged knot in the rusty scarf, his thumbs deep in the Finn's larynx.
Well, good luck, the Finn said.
He turned, hands in pockets, and began trudging back up the green arch.
Hey, asshole, the flatline said, when the Finn had gone a dozen paces.
The figure paused, half turned.
What about me? What about my payoff?
You'll get yours, it said.
What's that mean? Case asked as he watched the narrow tweed back recede.
I want to be erased, the construct said. I told you that, remember?
Straylight reminded Case of deserted early morning shopping centers he'd known as a teenager, low-density places where the small hours brought a fitful stillness, a kind of numb expectancy, a tension that left you watching insects swarm around caged bulbs above the entrance of darkened shops. Fringe places just past the borders of the sprawl, too far from the all-night click and shudder of the hot core. There was that same sense of being surrounded by the sleeping inhabitants of a waking world he had no interest in visiting or knowing, of dull busyness temporarily suspended, of futility and repetition soon to wake again. Molly had slowed now, either knowing that she was nearing her goal or out of concern for her leg. The pain was starting to work its jagged way back through the endorphins, and he wasn't sure what that meant. She didn't speak, kept her teeth clenched, and carefully regulated her breathing. She'd passed many things that Case hadn't understood, but his curiosity was gone. There had been a room filled with shelves of books, a million flat leaves of yellowing paper pressed between bindings of cloth or leather, the shelves marked at intervals by labels that followed a code of letters and numbers, a crowded gallery where Case had stared through Molly's incurious eyes at a shattered, dust-stenciled sheet of glass, a thing labeled. Her gaze had tracked the brass plaque automatically. La mariée mise à nu par ses célibataires même. She'd reached out and touched this, her artificial nails clicking against the Lexan sandwich protecting the broken glass. There had been what was obviously the entrance to Tessier Ashpool's cryogenic compound, circular doors of black glass trimmed with chrome. She'd seen no one since the two Africans and their cart, and for Case, they'd taken on a sort of imaginary life. He pictured them gliding gently through the halls of Straylight, their smooth, dark skulls gleaming, nodding, while the one still sang his tired little song. And none of this was anything like the Villa Straylight he would have expected, some cross between Kath's fairy tale castle and a half-remembered childhood fantasy of the Yakuza's inner sanctum. 7:02:18. 1.5 hours. "Case," she said, "I want a favor." Stiffly, she lowered herself to sit on a stack of polished steel plates, the finish of each plate protected by an uneven coating of clear plastic. She picked at a rip in the plastic on the topmost plate, blades sliding from beneath thumb and forefinger. "Leg's not good, you know. Didn't figure any climb like that, and the endorphin won't cut it much longer. So maybe, just maybe, right, I got a problem here. What it is, if I buy it here before Riviera does..." And she stretched her leg, kneaded the flesh of her thigh through modern polycarbon and Paris leather. "I want you to tell him. Tell him it was me, got it? Just say it was Molly. He'll know, okay?" She glanced around the empty hallway, the bare walls. The floor here was raw lunar concrete, and the air smelled of resins. "Shit, man, I don't even know if you're listening." "Case." She winced, got to her feet, nodded. "What's he told you, man? Wintermute. He tell you about Marie France? She was the Tessier half. Three Jane's genetic mother. And of that dead puppet of Ashpool's, I guess? Can't figure why he'd tell me down in that cubicle. Lot of stuff. Why he has to come on like the Finn or somebody. He told me that. It's not just a mask. It's like he uses real profiles as valves. Gears himself down to communicate with us. Call it a template. Model of personality." She drew her Fletcher and limped away down the corridor. The bare steel and scabrous epoxy ended abruptly, replaced by what Case at first took to be a rough tunnel blasted from solid rock. Molly examined its edge, and he saw that, in fact, the steel was sheathed with panels of something that looked and felt like cold stone. She knelt and touched the dark sand spread across the floor of the imitation tunnel. It felt like sand, cool and dry, but when she drew her finger through it, it closed like a fluid, leaving the surface undisturbed. A dozen meters ahead, the tunnel curved. Harsh yellow light threw hard shadows on the seamed pseudo-rock of the walls. With a start, Case realized that the gravity here was near Earth normal, which meant that she'd had to descend again after the climb. He was thoroughly lost now. Spatial disorientation held a peculiar horror for cowboys. But she wasn't lost, he told himself. Something scurried between her legs and went ticking across the unsand of the floor. A red LED blinked. The brawn. The first of the hollows waited just before the curve, a sort of triptych. She lowered the Fletcher before Case had had time to realize that the thing was a recording. The figures were caricatures in light, life-size cartoons. Molly, Armitage, and Case. Molly's breasts were too large, visible through tight black mesh beneath a heavy leather jacket. Her waist was impossibly narrow. Silvered lenses covered half her face. She held an absurdly elaborate weapon of some kind, a pistol shape nearly lost beneath a flanged overlay of scope sights, silencers, flash hiders. Her legs were spread, pelvis canted forward, her mouth fixed in a leer of idiotic cruelty. Beside her, Armitage stood rigidly at attention in a threadbare khaki uniform. His eyes, Case saw, as Molly stepped carefully forward, were tiny monitor screens, each one displaying the blue-gray image of a howling waste of snow, the stripped black trunks of evergreens bending in silent winds. She passed the tips of her fingers through Armitage's television eyes, then turned to the figure of Case. Here, it was as if Riviera, and Case had known instantly that Riviera was responsible, had been unable to find anything worthy of parody. The figure that slouched there was a fair approximation of the one he glimpsed daily in mirrors. Thin, high-shouldered,
a forgettable face beneath short dark hair. He needed a shave, but then he usually did. Molly stepped back. She looked from one figure to another. It was a static display, the only movement the silent gusting of the black trees in Armitage's frozen Siberian eyes.
"Trying to tell us something, Peter?" she asked softly.
Then she stepped forward and kicked at something between the feet of the hollow Molly. Metal clinked against the wall, and the figures were gone. She bent and picked up a small display unit.
"Guess he can jack into these and program them direct," she said, tossing it away.
She passed the source of yellow light, an archaic incandescent globe set into the wall, protected by a rusty curve of expansion grating. The style of the improvised fixture suggested childhood somehow. He remembered fortresses he'd built with other children on rooftops and in flooded sub-basements. A rich kid's hideout, he thought. This kind of roughness was expensive, what they called atmosphere. She passed a dozen more holograms before she reached the entrance to Three Jane's apartments. One depicted the eyeless thing in the alley behind the Spice Bazaar as it tore itself free of Riviera's shattered body. Several others were scenes of torture, the inquisitors always military officers, and the victims invariably young women. These had the awful intensity of Riviera's show at the XXe siècle, as though they had been frozen in the blue flash of orgasm. Molly looked away as she passed them. The last was small and dim, as if it were an image Riviera had had to drag across some private distance of memory and time. She had to kneel to examine it. It had been projected from the vantage point of a small child. None of the others had had backgrounds. The figures, uniforms, instruments of torture, all had been freestanding displays. But this was a view. A dark wave of rubble rose against a colorless sky. Beyond its crest, the bleached, half-melted skeletons of city towers. The rubble wave was textured like a net. Rusting steel rods twisted gracefully as fine string, vast slabs of concrete still clinging there. The foreground might once have been a city square. There was a sort of stump, something that suggested a fountain. At its base, the children and the soldier were frozen. The tableau was confusing at first. Molly must have read it correctly before Case had quite assimilated it, because he felt her tense. She spat, then stood. Children, feral in rags, teeth glittering like knives, sores on their contorted faces, the soldier on his back, mouth and throat open to the sky. They were feeding.
"Bon," she said, something like gentleness in her voice.
"Quite the product, aren't you, Peter? But you had to be. Our Three Jane, she's too jaded now to open the back door for just any petty thief. So Wintermute dug you up. The ultimate taste, if your taste runs that way. Demon lover. Peter." She shivered.
"But you talked her into letting me in.
Thanks. Now we're gonna party." And then she was walking, strolling really, in spite of the pain, away from Riviera's childhood. She drew the Fletcher from its holster, snapped the plastic magazine out, pocketed that, and replaced it with another. She hooked her thumb in the neck of the modern suit and ripped it open to the crotch with a single gesture, her thumb blade parting the tough polycarbon like rotten silk. She freed herself from the arms and legs, the shredded remnants disguising themselves as they fell to the dark false sand. Case noticed the music then, a music he didn't know, all horns and piano. The entrance to Three Jane's world had no door. It was a ragged 5-meter gash in the tunnel wall, uneven stairs leading down in a broad, shallow curve, faint blue light, moving shadows, music. "Case," she said, and paused, the Fletcher in her right hand. Then she raised her left, smiled, touched her open palm with a wet tongue tip, kissing him through the SimStim link. "Gotta go." Then there was something small and heavy in her left hand, her thumb against a tiny stud, and she was descending. Chapter 18. She missed it by a fraction. She nearly cut it, but not quite. She went in just right, Case thought. The right attitude. It was something he could sense, something he could have seen in the posture of another cowboy leaning into a deck, fingers flying across the board. She had it, the thing, the moves. And she'd pulled it all together for her entrance. pulled it together around the pain in her leg, and marched down Three Jane's stairs like she owned the place. Elbow of her gun arm at her hip, forearm up, wrist relaxed, swaying the muzzle of the Fletcher with the studied nonchalance of a Regency duelist. It was a performance. It was like the culmination of a lifetime's observation of martial arts tapes, cheap ones, the kind Case had grown up on. For a few seconds, he knew she was every badass hero, Sony Mao in the old Shaw videos, Mickey Chiba, the whole lineage back to Lee and Eastwood. She was walking it the way she talked it. Lady Three Jane Marie-France Tessier Ashpool had carved herself a low country flush with the inner surface of Straylight's Hall, chopping away the maze of walls that was her legacy. She lived in a single room so broad and deep that its far reaches were lost to an inverse horizon, the floor hidden by the curvature of the spindle. The ceiling was low and irregular, done in the same imitation stone that walled the corridor. Here and there, across the floor, were jagged sections of wall, waist-high reminders of the labyrinth. There was a rectangular turquoise pool centered 10 meters from the foot of the stairway, its underwater floods the apartment's only source of light. Or it seemed that way to Case, as Molly took her final step. The pool threw shifting blobs of light across the ceiling above it. They were waiting by the pool. He'd known that her reflexes were souped up, jazzed by the neurosurgeons for combat, but he hadn't experienced them on the SimStim link. The effect was like tape run at half speed, a slow, deliberate dance choreographed to the killer instinct and years of training. She seemed to take the three of them in at a glance, the boy poised on the pool's high board, the girl grinning over her wine glass, and the corpse of Ashpool, his left socket gaping black and corrupt above his welcoming smile. He wore his maroon robe. His teeth were very white. The boy dove, slender, brown, his form perfect. The grenade left her hand before his hands could cut the water. Case knew the thing for what it was as it broke the surface, a core of high explosive wrapped with 10 meters of fine, brittle steel wire. Her Fletcher whined as she sent a storm of explosive darts into Ashpool's face and chest, and he was gone, smoke curling from the pocked back of the empty white-enameled pool chair. The muzzle swung for Three Jane as the grenade detonated, a symmetrical wedding cake of water rising, breaking, falling back. But the mistake had been made. Hideo didn't even touch her then. Her leg collapsed. In Garvey, Case screamed. "It took you long enough," Riviera said as he searched her pockets. Her hands vanished at the wrists in a matte black sphere the size of a bowling ball. "I saw a multiple assassination in Ankara," he said, his fingers plucking things from her jacket. "A grenade job, in a pool. It seemed a very weak explosion, but they all died instantly of hydrostatic shock." Case felt her move her fingers experimentally. The material of the ball seemed to offer no more resistance than temper foam. The pain in her leg was excruciating, impossible. A red moire shifted in her vision. "I wouldn't move them if I were you." The interior of the ball seemed to tighten slightly. "It's a sex toy Jane bought in Berlin. Wiggle them long enough and it crushes them to a pulp. Variant of the material they make this flooring from. Something to do with the molecules, I suppose. Are you in pain?" She groaned. "You seem to have injured your leg." His fingers found the flat packet of drugs in the left back pocket of her jeans. "Well, my last taste from Ali, and just in time." The shifting mesh of blood began to whirl. "Hideo," said another voice, a woman's. "She's losing consciousness. Give her something, for that and for the pain. She's very striking, don't you think, Peter? These glasses, are they a fashion where she comes from?" Cool hands, unhurried with a surgeon's certainty, the sting of a needle. "I wouldn't know," Riviera was saying. "I've never seen her native habitat. They came and took me from Turkey." "The sprawl, yes. We have interests there. And once we sent Hideo. My fault, really. I'd let someone in, a burglar. He took the family terminal." She laughed. "I made it easy for him, to annoy the others. He was a pretty boy, my burglar. Is she waking, Hideo? Shouldn't she have more?" "More, and she would die," said a third voice. The blood mesh slid into black. The music returned, horns and piano, dance music. Case, Jack out.
After images of the flashed words danced across Malcolm's eyes and creased forehead as Case removed the trodes.
You scream, man, while ago.
Molly, he said, his throat dry, got hurt.
He took a white plastic squeeze bottle from the edge of the G-web and sucked out a mouthful of flat water.
I don't like how any of this shit is going.
The little cray monitor lit, the fin against a background of twisted, impacted junk.
Neither do I. We got a problem.
Malcolm pulled himself up over Case's head, twisted, and peered over his shoulder.
Now who is that, Mon Case?
That's just a picture, Malcolm, Case said wearily. Guy I know in the sprawl. It's Wintermute talking. Picture's supposed to make us feel at home.
Bullshit, the Finn said. Like I told Molly, these aren't masks. I need 'em to talk to you, because I don't have what you'd think of as a personality much. But all that's just pissing in the wind, Case, because, like I just said, we got a problem.
So express thyself, Mute, Malcolm said.
Molly's legs falling off for starts. Can't walk. How it was supposed to go down, she'd walk in, get Peter out of the way, talk the magic word out of 3-Jane, get up to the head and say it. Now she's blown it. So I want you two to go in after her.
Case stared at the face on the screen.
Us? So who else?
Errol, Case said. The guy on Babylon Rocker, Malcolm's pal.
No, gotta be you. Gotta be somebody who understands Molly, who understands Riviera, Malcolm for muscle.
You maybe forget that I'm in the middle of a little run here, remember? What you hauled my ass out here for.
Case, listen up. Time's tight, very tight. Listen.
The real link between your deck and Straylight is a sideband broadcast over Garvey's navigation system. You'll take Garvey into a very private dock, I'll show you. The Chinese virus has completely penetrated the fabric of the Hosaka. There's nothing in the Hosaka but virus now. When you dock, the virus will be interfaced with the Straylight custodial system and will cut the sideband. You'll take your deck, the flatline, and Malcolm. You'll find 3-Jane, get the word out of her, kill Riviera, get the key from Molly. You can keep track of the program by jacking your deck into the Straylight system. I'll handle it for you. There's a standard jack in the back of the head behind a panel with 5 zircons.
Kill Riviera?
Kill him. Case blinked at the representation of the fin. He felt Malcolm put his hand on his shoulder.
Hey, you forget something. He felt the rage rising and a kind of glee. You fucked up. You blew the controls on the grapples when you blew Armitage. Honeywas got us good and tight. Armitage fried the other Hosaka and the mainframes went with the bridge, right?
The Finn nodded.
So we're stuck out here, and that means you're fucked, man.
He wanted to laugh, but it caught in his throat.
Case, man, Malcolm said softly. Garvey a tug.
That's right, said the Finn, and smiled. You having fun in the big world outside? The construct asked when Case jacked back in. Figured that was Wintermute requesting the pleasure.
Yeah, you bet. Quang okay?
Bang on.
Killer virus.
Okay, got some snags, but we're working on it.
You want to tell me, maybe?
Don't have time.
Well, boy, never mind me. I'm just dead anyway.
Fuck off, Case said, and flipped, cutting off the torn fingernail edge of the flatline's laughter.
She dreamed of a state involving very little in the way of individual consciousness, 3-Jane was saying. She cupped a large cameo in her hand, extending it toward Molly. The carved profile was very much like her own. Animal bliss. I think she viewed the evolution of the forebrain as a sort of sidestep. She withdrew the brooch and studied it, tilting it to catch the light at different angles. Only in certain heightened modes would an individual, a clan member, suffer the more painful aspects of self-awareness.
Molly nodded. Case remembered the injection.
What had they given her?
The pain was still there, but it came through as a tight focus of scrambled impressions. Neon worms writhing in her thigh, the touch of burlap, smell of frying krill. His mind recoiled from it. If he avoided focusing on it, the impressions overlapped, became a sensory equivalent of white noise.
If it could do that to her nervous system, what would her frame of mind be? Her vision was abnormally clear and bright, even sharper than usual. Things seemed to vibrate, each person or object tuned to a minutely different frequency. Her hands, still locked in the black ball, were on her lap. She sat in one of the pool chairs, her broken leg propped straight in front of her on a camelskin hassock. Three Jane sat opposite, on another hassock, huddled in an oversized jalaba of unbleached wool. She was very young. "Where'd he go?" Molly asked. "To take his shot?" Three Jane shrugged beneath the folds of the pale, heavy robe and tossed a strand of dark hair away from her eyes. "He told me when to let you in," she said. "He wouldn't tell me why. Everything has to be a mystery. Would you have hurt us?" Case felt Molly hesitate. "I would have killed him. I'd have tried to kill the ninja. Then I was supposed to talk with you." "Why?" Three Jane asked, tucking the cameo back into one of the jalaba's inner pockets. "And why? And what about?" Molly seemed to be studying the high, delicate bones, the wide mouth, the narrow, hawk nose. Three Jane's eyes were dark, curiously opaque. "Because I hate him," she said at last. "And the why of that's just the way I'm wired, what he is and what I am." "And the show," Three Jane said. "I saw the show." Molly nodded. "But Hideo?" "Because they're the best. Because one of them killed a partner of mine once." Three Jane became very grave. She raised her eyebrows. "Because I had to see," Molly said. "And then we would have talked, you and I, like this?" Her dark hair was very straight, center parted, drawn back into a knot of dull sterling. "Shall we talk now?" "Take this off," Molly said, raising her captive hands. "You killed my father," Three Jane said, no change whatever in her tone. "I was watching on the monitors. My mother's eyes," he called them. "He killed the puppet. It looked like you." "He was fond of broad gestures," she said. And then Riviera was beside her, radiant with drugs, in the seersucker convict outfit he'd worn in the roof garden of their hotel. "Getting acquainted? She's an interesting girl, isn't she? I thought so when I first saw her." He stepped past Three Jane. "It isn't going to work, you know." "Isn't it, Peter?" Molly managed to grin. "Wintermute won't be the first to have made the same mistake, underestimating me." He crossed the tiled pool border to a white enamel table and splashed mineral water into a heavy crystal highball glass. "He talked with me, Molly. I suppose he talked to all of us. You and Case, whatever there is of Armitage to talk to. He can't really understand us, you know. He has his profiles, but those are only statistics. You may be the statistical animal, darling, and Case is nothing but I possess a quality unquantifiable by its very nature." He drank. "And what exactly is that, Peter?" Molly asked, her voice flat. Riviera beamed. "Perversity." He walked back to the two women, swirling the water that remained in the dense, deeply carved cylinder of rock crystal, as though he enjoyed the weight of the thing. "An enjoyment of the gratuitous act. And I have made a decision, Molly, a wholly gratuitous decision." She waited, looking up at him. "Oh, Peter," Three Jane said, with the sort of gentle exasperation ordinarily reserved for children. "No word for you, Molly. He told me about that, you see. Three Jane knows the code, of course, but you won't have it. Neither will Wintermute. My Jane's an ambitious girl, in her perverse way." He smiled again. "She has designs on the family empire and a pair of insane artificial intelligences, kinky as the concept may be, would only get in our way. So, comes her Riviera to help her out, you see. And Peter says, sit tight. Play Daddy's favorite swing records and let Peter call you up a band to match, a floor of dancers, a wake for dead King Ashpool." He drank off the last of the mineral water. "No, you wouldn't do, Daddy. You would not do, now that Peter's come home." And then, his face pink with the pleasure of cocaine and meperidine, he swung the glass hard into her left lens implant, smashing vision into blood and light. Malcolm was prone against the cabin ceiling when Case removed the trodes. A nylon sling around his waist was fastened to the panels on either side with shock cords and gray rubber suction pads. He had his shirt off and was working on a central panel with a clumsy-looking zero-G wrench, the thing's fat counter-springs twanging as he removed another hex head. Marcus Garvey was groaning and ticking with G-stress. "The mute take an ionide doc," the Zionite said, popping the hex head into a mesh pouch at his waist. "Malcolm pilot the landing. Meantime, need we tool for the job?"
"You keep tools back there?"
Case craned his neck and watched cords of muscle bunching in the brown back. "This one," Malcolm said, sliding a long bundle wrapped in black poly from the space behind the panel. He replaced the panel, along with a single hex head to hold it in place. The black package had drifted aft before he'd finished. He thumbed open the vacuum valves on the work belt's gray pads and freed himself, retrieving the thing he'd removed. He kicked back, gliding over his instruments. A green docking diagram pulsed on his central screen and snagged the frame of Case's G-web. He pulled himself down and picked at the tape of his package with a thick, chipped thumbnail.
"Some men in China say the truth comes out this," he said, unwrapping an ancient, oil-slick Remington automatic shotgun, its barrel chopped off a few millimeters in front of the battered forestock.
The shoulder stock had been removed entirely, replaced with a wooden pistol grip wound with dull black tape. He smelled of sweat and ganja.
"That the only one you got?"
"Sure, man," he said,
wiping oil from the black barrel with a red cloth, the black poly wrapping bunched around the pistol grip in his other hand.
"I and I the Rastafarian Navy, believe it."
Case pulled the trodes down across his forehead. He'd never bothered to put the Texas catheter back on. At least he could take a real piss in the Villa Straylight, even if it was his last. He jacked in.
"Hey," the construct said, "old Peter's totally apeshit, huh?"
They seemed to be part of the Tessier Ashpool ice now. The emerald arches had widened, grown together, become a solid mass. Green predominated in the planes of the Chinese program that surrounded them.
"Getting close, Dixie?"
"Real close. Need you soon."
"Listen, Dix. Wintermute says Quang's set itself up solid in our Hosaka. I'm going to have to jack you and my deck out of the circuit, haul you into Straylight, and plug you back in, into the custodial program there," Wintermute says. "Says the Quang virus will be all through there. Then we run from inside through the Straylight net."
"Wonderful," the flatline said. "I never did like to do anything simple when I could do it ass backwards."
Case flipped. Into her darkness, a churning synesthesia where her pain was the taste of old iron, scent of melon, wings of a moth brushing her cheek. She was unconscious, and he was barred from her dreams. When the optic chip flared, the alphanumerics were haloed, each one ringed with a faint pink aura. 7:29:40.
"I'm very unhappy with this, Peter."
Three Jane's voice seemed to arrive from a hollow distance. Molly could hear, he realized, then corrected himself. The SimStim unit was intact and still in place. He could feel it digging against her ribs. Her ears registered the vibrations of the girl's voice. Riviera said something brief and indistinct.
"But I don't," she said, "and it isn't fun. Hideo will bring a medical unit down from intensive care, but this needs a surgeon."
There was a silence. Very distinctly, Case heard the water lap against the side of the pool.
"What was that you were telling her when I came back?"
Riviera was very close now.
"About my mother. She asked me to. I think she was in shock, aside from Hideo's injection. Why did you do that to her?"
"I wanted to see if they would break."
"One did. When she comes around, if she comes around, we'll see what color her eyes are."
"She's extremely dangerous. Too dangerous. If I hadn't been here to distract her, to throw up Ashpool to distract her, and my own Hideo to draw her little bomb, where would you be? In her power?"
"No," 3 Jane said. "There was Hideo. I don't think you quite understand about Hideo."
"She does, evidently." "Like a drink?"
"Wine, the white."
Case jacked out. Malcolm was hunched over Garvey's controls, tapping out commands for a docking sequence. The module's central screen displayed a fixed red square that represented the Straylight dock. Garvey was a larger square, green, that shrank slowly, wavering from side to side with Malcolm's commands. To the left, a smaller screen displayed a skeletal graphic of Garvey and Haniwa as they approached the curvature of the spindle.
We got an hour, man, Case said, pulling the ribbon of fiber optics from the Hosaka. His deck's backup batteries were good for 90 minutes, but the flatline's construct would be an additional drain. He worked quickly, mechanically, fastening the construct to the bottom of the Ono Sendai with micropore tape. Malcolm's work belt drifted past. He snagged it, unclipped the two lengths of shock cord with their gray rectangular suction pads, and hooked the jaws of one clip through the other. He held the pads against the sides of his deck and worked the thumb lever that created suction. With the deck, construct, and improvised shoulder strap suspended in front of him, he struggled into his leather jacket, checking the contents of his pockets. The passport Armitage had given him, the bank chip in the same name, the credit chip he'd been issued when he'd entered Freeside, 2 derms of beta-phenethylamine he'd bought from Bruce, a roll of new yen, half a pack of Yeheyuans, and the shuriken. He tossed the Freeside chip over his shoulders, heard it click off the Russian scrubber. He was about to do the same with the steel star, but the rebounding credit chip clipped the back of his skull, spun off, struck the ceiling, and tumbled past Malcolm's left shoulder. The Zionite interrupted his piloting to glare back at him. Case looked at the shuriken, then tucked it into his jacket pocket, hearing the lining tear.
"You missin' the mute, man," Malcolm said. "Mute say he be messin' the security for Garvey. Garvey dockin' as 'nother boat, boat they spectin' out of Babylon. Mute broadcastin' codes for us."
"We gonna wear the suits?"
"Too heavy," Malcolm shrugged. "Stay in web till I tell you."
He tapped a final sequence into the module and grabbed the worn pink handholds on either side of the navigation board. Case saw the green square shrink a final few millimeters to overlap the red square. On the smaller screen, Haniwa lowered her bow to miss the curve of the spindle and was snared. Garvey was still slung beneath her like a captive grub. The tug rang, shuddered. 2 stylized arms sprang out to grip the slender wasp shape. Straylight extruded a tentative yellow rectangle that curved, groping past Haniwa for Garvey. There was a scraping sound from the bow beyond the trembling fronds of caulk.
"Man," Malcolm said, "mind we got gravity."
12 small objects struck the floor of the cabin simultaneously, as though drawn there by a magnet. Case gasped as his internal organs were pulled into a different configuration. The deck and construct had fallen painfully to his lap. They were attached to the spindle now, rotating with it. Malcolm spread his arms, flexed tension from his shoulders, and removed his purple dread bag, shaking out his locks.
"Come now, man, if you say time be most precious."
Chapter 19. The Villa Straylight was a parasitic structure, Case reminded himself, as he stepped past the tendrils of caulk and through Marcus Garvey's forward hatch. Straylight bled air and water out of Freeside and had no ecosystem of its own. The gangway tube the dock had extended was a more elaborate version of the one he'd tumbled through to reach Haniwa, designed for use in the spindle's rotation gravity. A corrugated tunnel, articulated by integral hydraulic members, each segment ringed with a loop of tough, non-slip plastic, the loops serving as the rungs of a ladder. The gangway had snaked its way around Haniwa. It was horizontal, where it joined Garvey's lock, but curved up sharply and to the left, a vertical climb around the curvature of the yacht's hull. Malcolm was already making his way up the rings, pulling himself up with his left hand, the Remington in his right. He wore a stained pair of baggy fatigues, his sleeveless green nylon jacket, and a pair of ragged canvas sneakers with bright red soles. The gangway shifted slightly each time he climbed to another ring. The clips on Case's makeshift strap dug into his shoulder with the weight of the Ono Sendai and the flatline's construct. All he felt now was fear, a generalized dread. This book is continued on Cassette 6, Side 1.